Good morning, everybody. My name is Ted Weinstein. I'm a literary agent based here in San Francisco. And my job today is not to talk about your writing or your craft or anything about high art or literature, but instead just to talk about publishing as a business. So my goal in the next maybe 25 minutes or 30 minutes is to get you incredibly depressed and feeling absolutely hopeless. And then hopefully by the time we're done in about 45 minutes, I will at least have given you some ideas and some tools to understand that, all right, it's hard to climb Mount Everest, but at least here's what you need to give it a shot. So I'm going to steal a line from Andrea Brown, who's also here, a fellow agent, who I don't know if she coined it or she just passed it along, but she said there's basically one simple answer to the secret of publishing. And I'm going to give it to you, and it's 7 words. And at that point, you can all get up and leave because there's nothing more to say. The 7 magic words in publishing are, it's nice to see you again, Oprah. Which is a joke, but it's also true. How many people here have been on Oprah? 1? That's good. Almost every time I give a talk like this, there's one person who's been on Oprah. We'll talk later. Then in a little bit longer form is this front and back one-page handout. So if anybody doesn't have it, the ringleader here in the purple top will get you another copy. I want to talk first about the state of the industry overall. We all know the state of the U.S. economy. The state of the publishing industry is no different. It's a very, very tough time. But in publishing generally, let's forget the waves of current economic storms. In general, they're really just sort of several basic categories that are timeless. So in nonfiction, let's start with that. There are 3 different kinds of nonfiction, categorically. Please come in. Narrative nonfiction, history, biography, journalism, memoir, anything with a story. And what I often do, not to belittle the craft and the richness of a real book, but say to authors, great, imagine the movie. If you can imagine a movie with a plot, then at least that's what story means, that's what narrative means. What people love to do is call anything they write that isn't practical about health or personal finance, they call it narrative nonfiction. Well, it's got one word after another. No. What's the story? So, 2nd is the practical type of nonfiction. News you can use, very nuts and bolts. I represent personal finance and business and health and fitness and interior decorating. This is just very practical, information-oriented nonfiction, which is being threatened, of course, by the internet. I know my father's got a brain tumor, and first place I went, yes, I bought him a book, but in the 2 days while I waited for Amazon to deliver it to him out of town, I was all over the web. So they can complement each other, but it is changing the style of practical book publishing. And then the 3rd, and this is one that really doesn't have an analog in anything other than books, is what I call concept history or micro history. It's basically books about nouns. And as I said here jokingly, it's preferably a noun that changed the world. We all know that those categories of books that really started with a book called Longitude that came out a number of years ago by Davis Sobel. And what she did was basically take the invention of the chronometer and build an entire book around it. It was a narrative in the sense that it was based around a story, but the story wasn't about one guy and the trip. It was about a particular concept or an idea or an object. So if any of you have a noun that about which a book hasn't yet been written, please come see me after class because I think there's still some possibilities. In fiction, trends are timeless. Tell me a good story. It really is all about the tale. If you had told me a while ago that you were writing a novel about a young girl who at the age of 13 or 14 was brutally murdered by a neighbor, and she looks down from the heavens and watches as her family dissolves in grief, I don't know that I would have thought that's got great prospects for a novel. But that was Lovely Bones by Alice Siebold, which I think sold 6 million copies so far. So it's about how well you tell the story. It's important to have a pitch and a summary of what your novel's all about. But especially from our perspective as agents, idea's great, now show me your writing. Related to both of those categories, then, is memoir, which is a weird hybrid form. It is treated in the industry much more like fiction. Because, and don't take this personally, until you've fully finished a work, nobody believes you can do it. There are probably 6 million unfinished manuscripts in desk drawers around America or My Documents folders on desktops. That's just the way the world works. So especially for first fiction or first memoir, everybody knows who I am, don't worry about that, you need to have the full work finished. And as we found out with a couple of recent scandals, truth matters, not just truthiness. So I'm not going to chastise you any further, but please think very carefully about what you're doing when you're working in that genre. Sorry, I just realized my phone is on. If anybody else's phone is on, join me in turning it off. So those are the broad categories of books in a very general sense. I don't mean subcategories of what's the topic, but there's nothing new under the sun. What is new, we had a question yesterday in the agents panel, all right, what's different from 50 years ago? Well, let's talk about the industry now, and I'm going to spend a few minutes on that. It's not pretty, it's very business-like, but at least understand the context within which you're writing and trying to get your writing sold to readers or to publishers. The first most important trend that started a while back is the concentration in retailers. Barnes & Noble controls, what, about a quarter of the market? Amazon's up to around 16 or 20% of the market. What that means is, as in every other aspect of our lives, instead of the corner pet shop, although a few still survive, it's Petco and PetSmart. The same thing has happened with the big box retailers in book publishing. And a lot of lovely small booksellers went out of business. Some because they were being run as hobbies rather than businesses and didn't serve readers, and others because they were just large economic forces. And bigger has more leverage. So what happened is we ended up with Barnes & Noble and Borders, which is troubled but still around, and Amazon controlling an enormous amount of the market. For better or worse, they're there. And just as I was making fun of Oprah a few minutes ago, no one is ever allowed to diss Oprah in my presence. I must say a lot of the books she chooses are not my taste, but she has brought more people in our society to reading books than anybody else alive. So that by itself is worth praising because I make a living off this industry. It's important. Second is Barnes & Noble. If anybody disses Barnes & Noble in my presence, even with Andy Ross or any other independent bookseller next to me, you're going to have a fight. And the reason why is not that they haven't had some negative effects, especially on lovely small booksellers, but because they have brought 20,000 volume bookstores to cities around America that never had a big bookstore before. Bringing books to readers is by itself a good thing, with lots of implications, good and bad. So when you have these big retailers, what that does in turn is it drives concentration of the publishers. And as Michael said yesterday, he calls them the six sisters, you can call them five and a half, whatever it is, there's a limited number of large publishers. And for those of you that have read some of the industry news in the past few weeks, that number, the imprints within those publishers have actually diminished. It's a brutal time in book publishing. There have been an enormous number of layoffs, and some of the imprints within big publishers have just gone poof. So the big publishers are the conglomerates, almost all of them publicly traded. Bertelsmann, Pearson, News Corp, Viacom, Hachette, Holzbrink, and then sort of a mini-major is Perseus, which is privately held and has actually done some very smart publishing and acquiring small imprints. So what I did was I put on to the right of each of these, there's the parent company on this list, and then look at some of the imprints within them. And what an imprint means, for those of you who don't know, is simply a mini operation that handles many but not all of the functions of a full-blown publisher. So it could be as little as just acquiring and editing great books, and then shared services from the parent corporation for obviously printing, but marketing and sales and so on. Whereas other imprints have much more of their own publicity and other functions in-house. But each imprint has a personality. And that's a lot of what agents do, is try to figure out not just which publisher is right for you, but more importantly, which editor at which imprint might be right for you. This is still a personal business even when you have corporations involved. And just for fun, you'll see that I just did strikeouts through a couple of those imprint names. Several of those imprints disappeared, even if the name survives, they disappeared as independent entities just within the past 3 or 4 weeks. So it's very much bumper cars in the industry. A lot of our friends have lost their jobs, and I say friends, and I mean that. We're a very small industry, and the editors that agents work with become buddies over time. And there are a lot of folks looking for work right now, and it's unclear where they're going to get work. So there are personal impacts to these big corporate changes. But as Michael asked yesterday, how many here want to be published by a big press? And the implicit point to that question is a big press isn't necessarily best for you. There are, the most important is for you to think, all right, what is it you're trying to accomplish? Who are you trying to reach with your words and your insight? And then over time you figure out what are the best media to use, what are the best venues, who are the best people to use as tools on your behalf. So the academic presses are still around. We all know that universities are pinched. Certainly the academic presses aren't flush with money. But for the past, maybe 10, 20 years, they have increasingly been moving to publishing a broader range of book, not just the dissertation turned to monograph or not just the textbook. So one of my favorite, funniest days in publishing was early on when I started agenting, and I was in New York meeting with a bunch of editors. And in the morning, I met with a trade publisher. And, tell me what you're doing and how your business is. And they said, yeah, we really want to publish more academic books. Because once you get a course adoption, then it becomes an annuity. And every year, you're going to have a nice, steady income. So that's great. Okay, good to know. So when I have more academic-y kind of stuff, I'll know that it's okay to bring it to you. And then I think that's my bag. That's okay. When I hear a zipper, I first check low and then I look back. Yeah. Okay. Leave chocolate in there. That's good. Okay. And then the same afternoon, I went and was chatting with an editor in Academic Press who said, yeah, we really want to do more trade books because if you get a bestseller, then you got a lot of income to support the rest of your program. So I quietly and to myself giggled. Here you've got, it's basically grass is always greener. But the academic presses are pursuing a broader range of publishing. And you need to be thoughtful, as with any trade imprint. What do they specialize in? How well do they do? They often don't have the marketing resources or aptitudes. But sometimes academic presses can be great partners for an author. And then the small publishers always exist. And in this day and age, they are even more of them. Depending on how you count, this past year, either 180 or 400,000 books were published. A chunk were from the big publishers, and some from the academic presses. A lot at the other extreme were from individuals using the self-publishing tools, which I'll get to in a moment. And then in between were thousands by folks that are small publishers, publishing 1, 2, 5, 10 books a year, maybe not making an enormous amount of money, but sometimes doing quite well at helping writers reach readers. So I do not have an inherent bias against small publishers. Our reputation is that we are greedy, true, that we are greedy on your behalf, certainly true, and that a big advance often will translate into a stronger commitment by a publisher once the book is done and ready to be published. But not always is that the most important set of criteria to decide who you're going to publish with. I have, I guess he's not here this week, and I have a client that I sometimes bring up if he's around to talk about. He had multiple offers from major and mid-sized New York publishers. And I encouraged him, and he decided to take an offer from a smaller publisher. Because being the 23rd book on the spring list at a big imprint may not be as good for you as being the first or second or third book on the top of the list of a smaller publisher's spring list. So there are lots of outlets. Small publishers definitely are troubled. Not every small publisher is going to be around a year from now. But as I talked about a few minutes ago, that's true also of imprints at the big publishers. So all of this requires thought, deliberation, research, study, and a lot of agonizing. That's the fun part. So, and then I will say the words, and then I have nothing to teach you about self-publishing because I know nothing about it. I can't make a living off it. I have some clients who, if we're not having success pitching their projects to an appropriate publisher, and they say, I really want to get my words out there, I'll encourage them to self-publish, because it's about you, it's not about me. But because I don't make any money at that, I have no idea who's good, who's bad. I know there's at least one self-publishing vendor here this weekend. I know there are resources on the web, I just couldn't even point to them. So, but it is a legitimate possibility. And if you do self-publish, you need to keep in mind that you are taking on every one of the functions of a publisher. So if you're going to go down that route, be ready. The one question that does come up that I can comment on, often people have self-published and they ask the question, hey, I've done this well, I've sold 500 copies, can you now get me a book deal with a major publisher? There are a few examples of that. I don't know how many of you know E. Lynn Harris, the African-American novelist down south. And he self-published, and I think he sold 20,000 copies out of the trunk of his car. Yeah, at that point, he got a nice book deal from Simon & Schuster. But what no publisher wants to hear, what no agent wants to hear, is I self-published, I sold 300 copies, but I didn't really do any marketing, so that means, therefore, if you extrapolate to the whole country, it'll be 300,000. You need to prove the case much more strongly if you're going to go down that route. So it's okay to go down the self-publishing route. It can occasionally turn into an opportunity with a major publisher. But you got to treat it seriously, not just throw something at the wall and think that that's enough. and that that's going to buy you a greater opportunity. So do it deliberately and thoughtfully. I'm going to stop for a second so I can drink some tea for my sore throat. Are there any questions? I don't want this to be just one way. Yes?
I was under the impression that actually people have told me you can either go to an agent or go straight to a publisher.
Sure.
And there are two different routes.
The question is going straight to an agent or to a publisher. I started my agency 9 days before 9/11. Still managed to sell 3 books in the first 3 months, and you know, people don't stop, which is a reminder that the situation we're in now, publishers have to acquire, or 2 years from now they're going to have nothing to publish. But in the course of the aftermath of that, especially the anthrax scare, which has yet to be solved, publishers finally took the opportunity, the major publishers, to say, we're not even going to look at unsolicited submissions. You must go through an agent. They're actually worried about anthrax in their mailrooms. More importantly, they knew that they're not great scouts. I love it that there are some editors here, but I always ask them, they're here to drink with us late at night, we can't talk about that. But if you talk to an editor who says, hey, this is really intriguing, most often they're going to say, great, send it to me, but eventually we're going to want you to have an agent. I'm not going to pitch you on why agents are good and all the different things we do, but editors are trying to edit and work within a publishing company. We're scouting, but we're also playing coach for you and playing all the functions I'll talk about in a moment. Let's talk about the changing roles of authors, editors, and agents. And in the midst of the big industrial changes, everything getting larger, the stakes getting higher, what is it that publishers are looking for? And what it really means is they're looking for you to bring synergy, platform, sort of, you need to be a multimedia empire. Because they're larger companies trying to shoot for bigger and bigger hits. And what I like to do is look for parallels in other industries. It always helps me clear my own thinking. So look at Hollywood. And in Hollywood, it's become much more a blockbuster mentality. As in book publishing, anybody now could make a movie. Scott James is walking around, Kemble Scott is walking around with a little flip, you know, it's an HD quality video camera that's the size of my cell phone and costs $200. So anybody can make a movie. Distribution is the challenge. Same as with books. Anybody can get a book self-published for $100. The question is distribution. How do you get it in front of people's eyes? So the big publishers, they need books that at least they can say to themselves with a semi-straight face have the potential to be big bestsellers. It's a lot like Hollywood. What it also means is that the big publishers are doing less and less. In a big corporation, there are fewer and fewer editors trying to do more and more titles and doing more and more corporate work. P&Ls, offsites, meetings, et cetera, et cetera. So they've been outsourcing for the past 20 years all kinds of functions. I don't know if that's my phone, but I'm going to try turning. So, or it's somebody behind me, but we're not going to talk. So the question is, when you've got editors doing less, what does that do to everybody else? And what that means is that agents are doing more. So compared to Hollywood, Sony doesn't do much on a photo. What they do, a movie, they finance and they distribute. The big publishers, I'm overstating, and I hope there are no editors here in the room because they'll kick my rear end, but they're basically just financing a book with an advance and distributing it, selling it into the big retailers. I'm overstating, but to make the point. So what happens now is the agents are doing much more project development, much more of the work that editors used to do. Back in the old days, Bennett Cerf would take the an author to lunch and he'd have the leather elbow patches and 3 martinis and all that. Nowadays, in the words of Salman Rushdie, he said at one point, I've been publishing for 25 years. I've had more editors than I can even remember, and I've only had one agent that whole time. And that's much more what's happening, that we're the ones that are scouting and working with people on a career basis because we help package projects to take them to publishers. So that's the emerging dynamic. And the editors at the publishing houses, they are now really acquiring more than editing. And I don't want to overstate, there are still some great editors who really do work on a manuscript. And those are the folks I try to sell my clients' projects book to, my clients' books to. But they are more and more operating like Procter & Gamble marketing managers. So that's just the reality. So the Hollywood model is something to keep an eye on to understand better. And think about platform synergy. What are all of the ancillary products, ancillary venues that you can get yourself out? So, how many people here have had a Happy Meal all about themselves, right? I mean, that's really what it's about. In the movie business, you've got Lord of the Rings, which was a book. Now we've got movie, action figures, costumes, et cetera, et cetera. Not that all of you should have costumes that look like you. Well, it's a nice looking bunch, so, you know, that'd be okay. But my point is that having that many more ways to exploit an author's talents, it's the way you need to think, and it's the way that the publishers are thinking. All right, how many people here are depressed and hopeless? A show of hands? I know there's more of you. You're being shy. Okay. So let's now turn it around, and I'm going to talk maybe for another 10 minutes, and then I really do want it to be mostly questions from that point on. What do you do about this? Quick summary. Giant corporations at the bookseller level, at the publishing level, big wants to work with big. They're all looking for big hits that can make them a lot of money. It's just structurally the way it has to be. What that means is then they're looking for book projects and authors that are big potential. And the way you assess big potential, it's, all right, what have you done already? None of us knows anything more than that. So what I always will repeat is you need to think of yourselves as a multimedia empire. I don't care what you're writing. It could be a great novel. It could be a practical book about probiotics. It could be anything, but you need to think of yourself as a multimedia empire. And that's not even about the web. If the web didn't exist, that would still be true, because you still have TV and radio and all kinds of other things. The point is, if you've got a gift and if you have something to say, I don't care what it is, you need to think very carefully, how are the ways you're going to get what you have to say out to as many of the most appropriate people as possible? So build your brand. Now I'm going to be really craven and pitch a client's book. The brand called you. A client of mine is named Peter Montoya. And he's a consultant and public speaker to mostly folks who run sole proprietorships, all about building personal brands. And it sounds very businesslike. I'm working on him to write a book just for authors, because there's some differences, obviously. We're not accountants. We're not lawyers. But it's the same mindset you have to bring to it. Who are you? What are you all about? Define yourself and communicate yourself to the world in as many different outlets as possible, in the largest possible outlets. So, you know, everything from your literal resume and your credentials to all the writing you do in any other venue. How many people here have their own name as a domain name, .com or .net? Oh, I love it. That's great. When I first started in this business, I've had TedWeinstein.com for about a decade because I used to work in the internet world. One is my friends from junior high school can always find me. Two is it becomes a brand over time. And for a long time, though, authors didn't get that. I'm so glad to see you've done that. It's wonderful. But outside of ourselves, it's also important to reach for other resources. A number of years ago, at Northern California, I'll share, I was making a bunch of dumb life decisions. And I finally said, that's it. I'm stopping. That's it. No more decisions. And my board of directors made all my life decisions. I'm an agent, actually, because a bunch of other people bullied me into being an agent. Collectively, the people that know us best and care about us most know us way better than we know ourselves. So it could be as impersonal as your writing group or writing teacher. It could be as close and personal as your parents or your kids or whatever. But think carefully, who are the people that are going to help you make good decisions about your writing and your career, even if writing isn't your full-time career? How many people here do not like to give advice? Yeah, I didn't see any hands. I didn't expect that. It's amazing the advice you'll get just for asking. People love to be told, implicitly and explicitly, you're smart. Can I buy a cup of coffee and get some advice? Don't be shy. You're obviously here at an event like this, and we're paid to be smart on your behalf. But there are a lot of other people who have all kinds of great things they can teach you. So in addition to your board of directors, who could be your personal posse, your editorial resources, writing group, copy editors, and so on. How many people here are in a writing group? Okay, that's not enough, and I'm going to get angry. By the end of this weekend, you will have had the opportunity to meet 299 other writers. And whether it's over the internet or in person, you need to be communicating with peers. One, because free advice is worth different things than paid advice. It comes to you in a different way. And two, in the course of trading advice and giving advice to others, you'll become smarter as well about your own writing. So please, whether it's over the internet or in person, with one person or 30, please find some writing buddies, some writing peers. Lawyer, accountant, literary agent, you know, I hope you need all that, especially the accountant part. That's great. My dad always said he wanted to take the IRS guy to dinner once a year and write him a check for $3 million because that would mean he'd made that much more. So I hope you need to pay all kinds of outsiders to manage your vast fortunes. The last one I put on the bottom of this page is booksellers. Whether indie or chain, the individual human beings who work at bookstores are great, smart people who know more about the book business than any of us. More importantly, they know more about what people are buying and why. cultivate your local bookseller. One, it's fun. They're nice people. They think about books all day. Two, when the time comes, you're ready for a reading, they're going to be much more receptive if they've seen you in there spending money and chatting with them and asking them advice and questions. So don't forget that the food chain from author, yeah, there's no whiteboard here, I draw it, from author all the way to reader includes lots of different people. Agents and editors, certainly, but further along, booksellers and others who put on reading events, for example. Cultivate everybody because it's going to help your career. I often teach a three-hour workshop on what I call a book proposal boot camp, mostly focused on nonfiction, and it's available actually on my website. You can stream it from a writer's conference in Texas. And I go through in-depth all about the book proposal and the nuts and bolts, and that's not what this course is all about. Michael Larson's giving a how to write a book proposal session, I believe, later. Definitely worth seeing. He and I teach differently, but it's all the same material. It's just a business plan. But what I will do very quickly is talk about the key principles to think about, and then we'll go to questions. One, from idea to book tour, may not be the right model. How many people here want to go on a book tour? Okay, we're calling in the psychiatrists because you do not have any real idea why that's not a great idea. You will hear far too many published authors, published by big houses, who show up at a bookstore, and there are three people there, one of whom they already knew. Another one got lost looking for the bathroom. So book tours may or may not be the right way to get yourself out there. The ambition to get your words and your insights into readers' hands and eyes, yes, that's great. But again, I'm going to repeat this again and again in the hallway the rest of today. Think carefully, think smart, think creatively. What are the best venues for you to accomplish what your goals are? Don't think that the success is, hey, I got a big contract, or I got a big publisher, or I got this agent to represent me. Your success is when you reach the readers that you want to reach. Don't ever forget that. Just keep your eyes on that prize, and everything else becomes much clearer. In the fiction and memoir world, when you're pitching us and then onward to publishers, as I said a little while ago, you gotta have it all done. So I call it Missouri rules. Show me. We get queries all the time, my novel's about XYZ. Okay, that's fine, but I can't help you until I see. Or, well, I've done three chapters. Great. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be doing this for 40 more years. When you're done, send me the first 40 pages. I wrote a book years ago. I actually backed into agenting through some other agents that I was pitching. And I needed some feedback. And so I sent stuff out before I really had the full proposal ready. And then people said, great, we'd like to see more. And I had nothing. And so it was that, oh, I'll get back to you. I'm so sorry. Nobody was offended. But if you're looking for validation, go to the parking garage. You ain't going to get it from agents and editors until you're really ready to pitch us. So be smart about that. So in nonfiction, there, however, you don't have to have the book finished. It's about the book proposal, which is a business plan. And again, you can listen to a full length talk on my website. You can go to Michael's panel. You can read Michael's book, learn how to write that business plan. Selling the book, once you're sold it to us, it's a lot of waiting. And patience is really important. So book publishing is slow. The bad news is it can take years between you even getting an agent to when a book would come out. That's also good news in the current economic environment. Again, we're all thinking very long term. And except for those people that are stocking up on guns and gold, the rest of us assume that things will get better at some point in the future. Books are still selling. Things don't go to zero. I'm still buying books. So have a sense of patience. Have a sense of nothing's going to stop me. But understand the pace at which this industry works, especially if you come from other industries. As I said, I came out of the dot-com world, and here I am 7 or 8 years later. I still drives me crazy, the pace at times, but there are reasons for it. So, and the big thing is just writing the book. You know, there's a lot of business outside, and I'm glad you're here not to listen to me. I got no ego about that, but I'm glad you're here this weekend and learning as much as you can about the business side of publishing. Presumably, you want to find your slot there someplace. Absorb it all, think about it all, and then after the long weekend, maybe Tuesday, put it all aside and go back to your writing. Have it there as context, have it there in the back of your head. The core of your potential success still is your talent, your drive, and what you do for yourself, the professionalism you bring to your writing. The business end will take care of itself at some point. So, she's waving numbers at me. We've got about 15 minutes, so I'm going to stop for questions, and I'll start in the back, but I'll come back to you. All the way in the back, with one with the glasses.
I have an interest in self-publishing communication, and my own assumption is that as times get tougher, that kind of book might actually be better. and why it's so supportive.
Sure. The question is a book that might seem timely, especially a self-help book dealing with anxieties about the present, when we all have anxieties about the present. I'll answer your question, but only in the general sense. Some books are timely, and getting them out quickly, that they are really astute and right for this moment, can do very well. In the 2 weeks since Bernie Madoff was discovered as a crook taking $50 billion from people, three different book deals were announced. And people are rushing those to print because there's still some fascination. Oh, on practical books that have to do with current times, yes, there can be an opportunity. Certain types of books, no question. Timeliness matters. It is part of your sales pitch to an agent and then to an editor. A couple things just to keep in mind, though. One, again, a book may not come out. Even if you crash a book out, it's not going to be out for at least a year. So it's got to be the kind of book that warrants crashing and that will last. There may be other places for you to share your wisdom, whether it's on Oprah or in a magazine, where the timeliness is much tighter. You can get those insights out in a quicker way. So if timeliness is a benefit for the project you're pitching, you need to make an argument why books are still the right format for material that's that timely. Yes?
You mentioned serialization in part three of your outline here, under style. If you have a manuscript or you have some very short stories that could even be transmitted electronically each, you know, once a week or whatever. But if you have a manuscript that is very amenable to being serialized, mm-hmm. where do you go? I mean, how do you pitch, hey, I have a serial?
Right. The question is serialization, which for those who don't know the terminology, first serial means when, and it's S-E-R-I-A-L, not breakfast cereal. Means that you are publishing a selection before the publication of a book. Second serial means publishing in a journalistic outlet a chunk of your book after the book itself was published. So I want to talk about that not in terms of serial, but rather in terms of portions. Because sometimes if you're just publishing pieces, that's great because that's building a career. All of you should be, whether you're novelists or otherwise, should be trying to get yourself out there publishing your words even before a book project's ready to go. If there is a full book ready or planned in a book proposal form and there are chunks that make sense to pull out and publish separately, it's an open question. I can't give you a single answer. It may make sense to publish some of those now as a teaser to get agents and editors interested and show that you're already hot stuff. Or it may make sense just in a proposal, for example, to say chapters 1, 5, 7, and 12 each in their own way might make sense for The New Republic or O Magazine or Ladies Home Journal. So it's very important to think about that. There is no one answer. But look at how you can slice and dice. And for fiction, publishing short stories could be the exact same range of possibilities. Publishing stuff first to show that you're good and people like your writing, or to say, hey, some of these chapters might make sense to serialize later to build interest when the book is ready to be published. Yes?
You talked about...
In back. I'll come back to you in a sec. Yeah?
What's your opinion of people... using the freelance editors that you pay in advance to help you finish your manuscript before finding
it? The question is, what do I think of freelance editors? And like anything else, there are great freelance editors and not so great ones. I will say that there is something just to think about, which is all about incentives. Freelance editors are getting paid by you. Some freelance editors have a built-in incentive to keep things going. I have a friend, I apologize if this offends anybody, but I've got a friend who's been in therapy for 14 years. I keep telling her she should put that on her entertainment budget, not her healthcare budget. I don't mean to diss therapy, but if it ain't working after 14 years, we need to have a talk. So, and I say that, again, not to diss any freelance editors. There are some here today that actually came out of publishing houses. I know that they're brilliant editors. And if you feel they're adding value to your work, they're absolutely worth paying. So I don't have an inherent bias against or for. The question is, are you getting the help you need that's making your writing, making your work that much better? Sir?
You talked about horizontal concentration in the publishing industry. Do you see a virtual vertical concentration where you as an agent are going to take my book to Walmart or Costco and right. say, this is really great, why don't you tell the editor that he right. needs to publish it?
The question is there going to be a vertical concentration in publishing where agents are going to be everything? And I'll say this not to be self-serving, but I've been predicting that actually for the past 5 or 6 years. That in a certain sense, once we move to print on demand, I don't mean self-publishing, but print on demand, when there is the printing machine behind the counter at Barnes & Noble, as there already are in Amazon's warehouse, and the big publishers are doing less and less sort of outsourcing all the functions, the big publishers are working themselves out of a living. Because they're doing less and less, and if you're not adding value, people aren't going to come to you anymore. So I do believe that over time there is a possibility of the agencies becoming the new publishers. That if the five biggest agencies said tomorrow to the big publishers, we're done, we're not bringing you any more projects, we're actually going to work with Amazon to publish directly and Barnes & Noble to publish directly, there would be an enormous earthquake. It would be messy, but yeah, that could be the future. But none of that should affect the way you think. You need to find a good agent, whether or not we are everything or just the next step. Yes?
Were you referring only to fiction when you said the first-time author should be finishing with the whole manuscript before approaching an agent?
Right. The question is, for whom is it important to have finished a full manuscript? And yes, that's only for fiction and memoir. Because again, until you've done it, just because you've written a short story, well, it's sort of like saying, hey, I run 3 miles every day, does not mean you're ready for a marathon. So for full narrative manuscript of fiction and memoir, not invariably, but almost always you need to be done. For nonfiction, it's about the book proposal, which almost invariably must include a long sample of what the book's going to be all about, at least a sample chapter.
And now that I know for nonfiction, a book proposal is sufficient, how common it is for an agent to work with the author on actually knocking out maybe a chapter or adding another?
The question is, how much work will agents do based on just seeing a proposal? I'll tell a quick story about a client who became a client, sent me a cover letter. It was perfect. It was on her letterhead from university, so I understood her credentials. Hey, she knows what she's doing. In a page and a half, she outlined why she had a topic that hadn't been written about at book length, why it was timely and important, who the readership was going to be, what was new. There it was in a page and a half. By the time I was done, I was ready to lick the pages. It was so good. And I was ready to represent her. I hadn't even seen a word of her writing, but if she could write a letter, that great. And of course, I requested the manuscript. Several of us did. We ended up fighting over her and ended up with her as a client, and she went on to win academic prizes with the book. But that's one example. Don't say, great, if I write the perfect query letter, then all else will be easy. We are always, as humans, as individuals, making judgments. We look at some material, we're trying to figure out, is this something I want to invest my time in? We don't get paid until the end, just like you. We don't get paid if a project doesn't sell. So we're making, essentially, bets all the time. So any of you could say, start with a pitch, you know, give me 2 sentences and a quick email. Sure. Or a cover letter. Sure. Better is, the more you've got ready about yourself and your credentials and your platform, the more you've got ready about the book itself, the more likely you are to get our help at making it even better. There are, let's see, out of my, I don't know, 70 or 80 clients, precisely zero that I have taken their first proposal and taken it to publishers verbatim. We put a lot of work in. We need to. Because we know things you don't know. It's not a judgment about you. It's not saying you'll never get it right. We work with all of our clients to polish proposals. It's up to you when you're pitching an agent for the first time to figure out how, make the extra effort. What's the best you can do to present yourself well to give us the most confidence that our time will be well spent? Yes?
Are book proposals being done by email nowadays, or is it just still through the mail?
In terms of sending a proposal to an agent, you should read every agent's website. We each have different preferences. In terms of submitting to publishers, it's sort of the same. Younger editors, not surprisingly, are more comfortable receiving a PDF, but that's something you don't have to worry about. Read every agent's website or listing in Jeff Herman's guide before you submit. Nothing will get you dinged sooner. Well, first is typos and bad language, bad English. Second is that you didn't read and you're not sending us, reaching out to us in a way we want to be heard from. I get more than 200 queries a week.
Wow.
It's not a judgment, but there's only so much time I can spend on that. And if you put it in my format, I can thoughtfully evaluate what you got much better. And that's true for every agent. So, all the way in the back row.
Hi, Tyler Brown, and I write lifestyles for newspapers and Chicago, and that's what I'm doing here. And I'm wondering, based on the work stories that you publish, is that our cookbooks and lifestyles
The question is, for lifestyle books, what's the most common route? And I would say fame and fortune. My 11-year-old nephew, back in the old days when I was a kid, you wanted to be a rock and roll star. That's how you got girls, right? My 11-year-old nephew wants to be a chef. You see that on TV. So I'm going to overstate to make the point. It's impossible to get a cookbook deal unless you either have a famous restaurant or you've got a TV show. Now, I'm overstating. Someone like you who has journalistic credentials and has written broadly, that's a third category where there may be lots of opportunity. And I mean more broadly than cooking, but in all lifestyle. Platform is key. Talent is key. If you're writing about a topic and you start with some journalistic credentials and contacts, that's great. That may be enough. What I would say is the other possibility for a journalist or a good writer is co-authorship. We don't have time to talk about that today, but happy to talk with anybody later. Any of you that are just writers that aren't famous, excuse me, but might want to work in a collaborative relationship, I broker those all the time. Lots of agents do that. We have a lot of famous people who don't have the time or the aptitude to write a book about their wisdom or their celebrity, but they'll work with an author, and that may also be another option for a journalist like you. So, yes?
You mentioned 200 proposals a week. Do you read them?
I read everything that comes in. Yeah. Question here.
If you're pitching a novel, a historical novel, is it wise or unwise to pitch it in terms of your profession as an academic, as a professor?
The question is, for a historical novel, if you have academic credentials about presumably that era, yes, that's an enormous benefit, and you shouldn't be shy about stating that as well. Obviously, the novel's got to be written in a way that everybody would love it just for itself, but as part of your query, absolutely. Talk about how you know that era. No question.
Thank you. Some editors and agents I've heard said that they very much want to work with their people throughout their whole careers to help build them, help mm-hmm. shape them. What kinds of things, presumably money occasionally and misfit, cause people to change in either case, and is it increasing?
The question is, how do agents and authors mate for life? And the answer is that it varies wildly. I have taken on clients who left their other agents, often with big New York agencies who didn't give them any attention, and have taken them on to bestsellerdom. I have lost a couple of clients through, you know what, we're just not a good fit. Even where, hey, this is a neat project, your second or third or fourth project, but I don't get it. I'm not going to be able to coach you in the right way. A client of mine, I actually then introduced her to another agent and passed her along. That agent got her the book deal because I realized I was not helping her shape the book in the right way. So these are intense, as Robert Shepard said yesterday, these are intensely personal relationships. So there are no rules to any of this. Relationships can fall apart over money, over love, over just lack of communication. None of us goes into a relationship with a writer expecting it won't work. We're always looking for things to continue. I'm certainly looking for a career relationship because getting to work well together takes time. And if I can help you sell multiple book deals, we all make that much more money and have a lot more fun together. Last question.
What few buzzwords inquiry letters turn you off immediately?
That's a really interesting question. Which buzzwords in queries turn me off? I'm actually, because this is being recorded, I'm not going to answer that directly. Because probably a third of the people in this room have used those buzzwords. And I'm saying that with a smile, but also seriously. We each are different. I've turned down clients who've gone on to great success with another author. I don't even understand what the book's all about or why anybody bought it, but they're bestsellers. And vice versa. So anybody's taste in a query letter, buzzwords are buzzwords. And I wouldn't worry about it. The one thing I would say is, for those of you in a writing group and the rest of you who will be in a writing group by the end of this weekend, don't just have your writing group working on your manuscript or proposal. Have them reviewing your query letter. That's your writing as well. So you should be getting feedback on everything. You'll get lots of good advice, and then it's still up to you to decide, both in the work itself and the way you try to present it to others, what's the right way to communicate. You choose your own words.
Is it the format that turns you down or turns you on, or is it the hook?
If you were somebody that I knew I could get on Oprah Weekly for the next 10 years, you could send me in crayon. I don't care. So I need to stop now. I need to be respectful of everybody's time. So what I'll say is, I'm going to be here all weekend. I don't have anything next, so kidnap me in the halls. Happy to talk to everybody. Thank you for coming.